Welcome to the Global Governance Podcast, where we explore the future of governance. Each episode will look at a different global issue and how governance plays a key role in its solution. From climate change to gender equality, from corruption to peace and security, we invite experts to explore a thought-provoking game of what if and why not, positing a world in much closer international cooperation. And now your host, Augusto López Claros. Enjoy.
Carolina Sanchez Paramo is the Global Director of the Poverty and Equity Global Practice at the World Bank. She holds a doctorate in economics from Harvard University and joined the bank in 2000. Over the past two decades, she has worked on operations, policy advice to the bank's member countries, and analytical activities in Eastern Europe, Latin America, and South Asia. She was a leading member of the team that wrote the World Development Report in 2012, titled Gender Equality and Development, which many of us who have written on gender issues regard as having substantially expanded the frontiers of knowledge about the heavy price that we pay in economic development terms by the subjugation of women. She has also helped design a cash transfer program in Ecuador that catalyzed the modernization of an important element of that country's social policies. More recently, given the economic hardships brought about by COVID-19, she and her team have used phone surveys in more than 100 countries to assess the impact of the pandemic and to better inform the bank and the authorities in those countries how to best respond to the crisis. She is thus singularly well qualified to share with us insights on poverty, equity, and some of the critical development challenges that we face today. Carolina, thank you for agreeing to participate in this podcast. We are really grateful to you for making the time available to talk to us. We know that you are a very busy person.
Thank you, Augusto. It's such a pleasure to be here. I really look forward to the conversation.
With your permission, and because I think it will help us to better organize our conversation around poverty issues today, I wanted to ask you whether we could initially focus on the pre-COVID-19 period. In particular, can you briefly describe for us, in broad terms, what progress has been made in reducing extreme poverty over the past three decades, say by early 2020?
As you know, we really started monitoring and measuring extreme poverty globally in 1990. So that's the period that we can talk about a little bit from 1990 till today. And when we look over those three decades, it's really a success story. And we've seen extreme poverty decline from over 35% of the global population to under 10% right before COVID. And I think that's something that we should celebrate, irrespective of the very challenging moment that we are in. Not only that decline was significant, but it was sustained. And, you know, there was only one period in these whole three decades when we saw poverty go up slightly, and that was during the Asian crisis. Other than that, year after year, we've seen these numbers decline. We've seen the poverty rate decline and the number of extreme poor decline. Having said that, in recent years, even before COVID, we were starting to be a little bit concerned because we had seen the pace of poverty reduction starting to slow down a little bit. So just to give you a sense, since 1990 to about 2013, the extreme poverty rate declined by 1 percentage point per year, almost mechanically. You know, it was a very constant pace of reduction. But from 2013 onwards, up to right before COVID, that pace slowed down to 0.5 percentage point per year. And even though that sounds like a very small difference, it does make a huge difference in terms of the number of people being lifted out of poverty.
Thank you, Carolina. That's useful. Let me ask you, is it accurate or correct to say that much of this progress that you have described since 1990 is on account of the very high economic growth rates that we have seen in the Chinese economy, which also happens to be the most populous country in the world? I remember seeing some charts generated at the World Bank some years ago when I was making a presentation that showed that something like 80% of the gain or the reduction in extreme poverty between 1990 and I guess at that time it must have been 2015, was actually accounted for by China. And in one of the poverty and equity reports published perhaps by your team a few years ago, I saw that the poverty rate, for instance, in Africa over that long period had remained broadly flat, you know, that you had had a reduction in poverty, but you had an increase in population, and therefore the poverty rate was flat. And so there is a kind of a China side to this poverty reduction story, which seems to be there. And just wanted to ask you to comment on that.
So you're right that China and East Asia in general have played an important role in when we look at the global story on poverty reduction, but they're not the only part of that story. So when we look over those three decades that we were just talking about, extreme poverty rates have declined in all regions, including in sub-Saharan Africa. But you're right that they have done so at very different speeds, with some regions having been much more successful in, you know, reducing and almost eliminating any extreme poverty than others. And what we see specifically is China and East Asia generally playing a very important role, as you just pointed out, in the 90s and early 2000s, as that region grew very strongly and they invested very heavily in education. Interestingly, in the late 2010s, South Asia sort of takes the lead as the engine of global poverty reduction, driven to a large extent by what's happening in India. So it's not surprising that you have, you know, two big countries, China and India, and as they move and make progress, so does the world. So that's a little bit the story. In the background, you have sub-Saharan Africa, where, as you said, progress has been much more limited. So the extreme poverty rate has declined, but population growth has been very high. So even though the incidence of poverty is lower, because that incidence applies to a much larger number of people, the actual number of poor has increased. And that's very worrisome to us. So in a way, when I look back, what I see, it's a bit of a two-speed world, right? Where you have most developing regions on the one hand, making significant progress, and sub-Saharan Africa on the other hand, with limited progress. And really what's been holding sub-Saharan Africa back, it's a combination of issues. On the one hand, economic growth has been slower than in other regions. Population growth has been higher, as we just said. So when you combine lower growth, higher population growth, you get very low per capita growth, which is really the critical factor. And then you also have very low levels of human capital to start with. So even when growth happens, there are large segments of the population that cannot take advantage of that growth.
Some prominent economists have made the following argument, that the extreme poverty line used by the bank of $1.90 per day is, extremely austere. Being extremely poor, according to this definition, suggests a degree of deprivation and vulnerability that is really difficult to reconcile with notions of human dignity. Nancy Birdsall, whom I'm sure you have met, I have known her for a long time from the times that she used to visit the World Economic Forum in Davos, has pointed out that if one were to move the poverty line from $1.90 to $5.50, something like 46% of the world's population would be considered poor. And in the characterization that she makes of people who live with this level of income, right, $5.50 per day, she says that she calls them strugglers. These are people who have difficulties, you know, meeting their, sort of making ends meet by the end of the month, you know. They live in a world of uncertainty and stress and some degree of suffering, I suppose. And this, in turn, is manifested in all kinds of social dysfunctions. In other words, do you agree that although we have made progress in reducing poverty over the last three decades, poverty is still, in fact, a major unresolved issue in the 21st century?
So the short answer to that is yes, but let me tell you why I think that's the case. And, you know, I'm going to sort of take a step back and then get to that. So first, let me say a couple of words about, you know, where these poverty lines come from. right? The $1.90 and the ones that we had before then. Because I think it's important to realize that, you know, the World Bank doesn't make up these lines, or, you know, other institutions don't make up these lines. These lines reflect what countries themselves set as the standards to consider somebody poor or not. And in particular, the extreme poverty line that we use globally, the $1.90, it's really the combination or the mean, if you want, of the national poverty line in the poorest countries in the world. So in a way, what that is reflecting is what poor countries consider to be poor in that context, right? So that's the first thing to keep in mind. You know, there's a rationale to why these numbers are there and why we use them the way we do. The second thing that is important to realize is that as countries get richer, that threshold, that national poverty line, usually tends to get higher. And what this reflects is a little bit what you were talking about. That is, for somebody to be considered non-poor in a middle-income country, the minimum sets of goods and services that they need to be able to have access to, it's probably larger than that of a person in a low-income country. Let me give you an example. Imagine you have a person that lives in a middle-income country that is more urbanized. In order to be able to access economic opportunities, this person maybe, you know, should have to afford transport, say, right? That may not be the case in a rural economy where people can walk or, you know, ride a bicycle. So we need to internalize that in our concept of poverty. And that's what explains that, you know, usually national poverty lines are higher in middle-income countries than in low-income countries. And that's also what underpins the two additional lines, poverty lines, that we introduced in 2018 at the World Bank. And those are $3.20 for low and middle-income countries and the $5.50 that you just talked about for upper middle income countries. You know, and what we were trying to do here was say, look, for low income countries, this may be the right standard. But when you think about middle income countries, we may want to think of a slightly higher standard because of the reasons that I just gave you. It is also true that when we first started talking about extreme poverty globally 30 years ago, the world was a lot poorer. So at that point, you know, even by this very, very low threshold, right? Really a threshold of deprivation, which is really this extreme poverty line. 30% of the global population was considered poor. So even that very low line was very relevant. It was a very relevant metric at that point in time. The world, of course, is now a much richer place, right? We have fewer low-income countries, many more middle-income countries. And I think that's what Nancy is reflecting on, that calls for a more expansive notion of what it means to be poor. So in that sense, I agree with her. And I think, again, that's very much the rationale for the introduction of these other poverty lines. And as you said, when we apply those standards, you know, that are, I think, more aligned with the average level of income that we see in the developing world, at $3.20, 25% of the global population could be considered poor. And at $5.50, almost 50% of the population could be poor. And what does that mean? You know, these are people that can probably afford food and housing, but, you know, they may not be able to afford transport. They may not be able to afford digital connectivity, which may be critical for their ability to access jobs. And they may not be able to afford other things that we consider necessary to be a functioning citizen, which is, I think, what you were alluding to, in a middle-income context. So in that broad sense, yes, I do agree with that statement. And that's very much what we try to reflect when we work in middle-income environments and talk about poverty in that context.
Our audience would be very interested in understanding the impact of COVID-19 on poverty and the setback that this implies, in particular for Sustainable Development Goal number one, right? To end poverty in all its forms everywhere by 2030. So share with us, you know, the numbers on extreme poverty as far as you can tell from the data that you have collected, what has happened during the past 12 months. And beyond that, you know, how vulnerable is the achievement of these goals, Sustainable Development Goal number one, to other such shocks such as the impact of climate change, which the scientists are telling us already quite insistently is expected to hit the developing world, especially harshly.
So let's start with COVID, and then let's take a bit of a longer-term perspective. There's no doubt that COVID-19 and the associated economic crisis is the biggest setback that we've seen during the three decades that we've been monitoring global poverty. And our latest projections, based on macroeconomic figures published in January by our colleagues at the bank, suggest that in 2020, over 120 million people were pushed into extreme poverty. And remember, we are saying, you know, we're pushed to live with less than $1.90 a day because of the pandemic. And this number could go up to 160 million in 2021, depending on the nature and the speed of the recovery, right? So there's some uncertainty, of course, around this second figure. And, you know, there's a rationale for why these numbers are so big. And it's the fact that, you know, the poor and the vulnerable, because of where they live and where they work, and the fact that they're very dependent on public services, both for health and education, are usually the most affected, not just in the current crisis, but in any crisis. So when you have a shock of the magnitude of the shock that we are living through, they are really the ones that are, if you want, shouldering most of the burden, and they are very exposed in terms of their vulnerability. So that's a massive setback, and it's going to take us, I think, a while to recover from that. But what's worrisome is that that is happening on the back of some very concerning long-term trends, which you just alluded to. And I want to sort of talk about two of those. One is climate change and the risks associated with that. And in a recent publication that we put out every 2 years called the Poverty and Shared Prosperity Report, in the last edition of that, which came out last October, we actually highlight that if unaddressed, climate risks could push an additional 130 million into extreme poverty by 2030. And again, why is that? Well, because usually the vulnerable, the less well-off, tend to live in areas that are more prone to risks, tend to be less able to cope with those risks in terms of investing in their housing, moving to safer areas, having insurance. So you can see how, you know, the policy environment and the risks compound themselves. The second trend is fragility and conflict. Unfortunately, the last few years have been witness to an increase in fragility and domestic conflict. And again, the poor are sort of at the forefront of that in terms of who's affected. So what we argue in the report is that when you combine what we call these three C's, COVID, climate, and conflict, you really have the perfect storm. And there are many places in the world where these three trends, long-term and short-term, are overlapping and generating, if you want, hotspots of poverty, which is basically places where you have a large number of poor and high exposure to these kinds of risks. So with that picture, I think the conclusion is that, you know, the 2030 goal of eliminating extreme poverty, it's now beyond reach unless we put in place swift, sustained, and significant policy action that addresses both the challenges generated by COVID, as long as the, you know, as well as these long-term trends in terms of dealing with climate change and really addressing the root causes of fragility and conflict.
That's a very sobering response, especially given that the whole Sustainable Development Goal framework, I think, was very much founded on this first goal, right? It was seen as the highest priority, and at that time, anyway, perhaps the easier to achieve. But this comments of yours take us to the next question, which is basically, you know, what are some of the lessons that have emerged from the pandemic with respect to the kind of public policies that have a bearing on poverty alleviation? For instance, it seems to me that one of the lessons has to do with the priorities of government spending. The crisis, the COVID, the pandemic, found many of our public health systems very vulnerable, very ill-prepared. And you know, even in high-income countries, you saw the systems, you know, having difficulties to cope with the intensity of the crisis. At a time when, according to an IMF study, we're spending in excess of 5% of global GDP subsidizing energy, electricity, carbon, gasoline, you know, multiple forms of energy consumption, which, of course, contributes to accelerate climate change. And the IMF study points out is also very regressive because 60% of the benefits are concentrated on the top 20% of the population. So should we evolve a new social contract? And if so, what would be the main elements?
The way I think about this is, you know, this is such an unprecedented crisis, right? At least in our lifetime, that it's perhaps not surprising that no country was really sort of fully prepared to deal with it. And I think you see that when you look at impacts, you know, in low income, middle income, and high income countries, right? They are large no matter what. And interestingly, and now I'm focusing more on sort of our countries of focus, the low income and middle income countries, I actually think that the effort that governments have made to respond to this crisis has been quite impressive in most places, with very rapid, very broad policies being put in place, particularly to support households and firms very quickly, you know, to put resources in sort of the pockets of individuals and to support firms from going under. And, you know, this has taken several forms, you know, safety nets, tax relief, financial measures. And in some places, we have seen, for example, an acceleration in the adoption of digital technologies to be able to reach out to firms and households at the time of lockdown and so on. So in that sense, you know, if you want to see the glass half full, I think a lot has happened that has probably accelerated reforms that we wanted to happen and now have happened sort of in a shorter span of time. The flip side of that is that in many cases, even though a lot of resources have been invested, these resources were not enough to provide sufficient support to all those that were affected. It's also become very clear that either, you know, where safety nets existed, they were often small and hard to scale up quickly, or it was hard to sort of shift them to target the new poor, right? So they were very effective in providing support to the existing poor, but not so effective in reaching the new poor, for example, right? So not agile and flexible enough. And as you just alluded to, we have seen really a bit of a collapse of social services, right? Both the health system because of, you know, COVID and so on, but also the education system, right? With the shutdown of schools and so on. So again, you know, a mixed picture, you know, very sort of rapid and significant response, but falling short of the demands of the time. So what do I take away from that in terms of thinking about the recovery? You know, can we use the recovery as an opportunity to maybe do things a little bit differently and invest a little bit differently from the way we've done in the past? And I think the answer is yes. And to me, what would be important, and again, I come to this from the perspective of households and individuals, right? So that's my bias, if you want, is that we think about the way we design policies moving forward in a way that ensures that they are both inclusive and that they are building resilience, both at the level of the households and systemic resilience. So let me give you a couple of examples. In thinking about safety nets, I think we need to invest a lot more in these safety nets being adaptive, meaning having the capacity to target not just in terms of chronicity of poverty, but in terms of vulnerability and exposure to risks. And this is something that we are doing in some countries, but that we should try to generalize much more broadly. We need to accelerate digital inclusion. You know, the resilience of public service provision to a shock like the one we've had now would be enormously strengthened if we were able to smoothly transition kids and families to telemedicine or digital learning, something that hasn't happened, right, during the crisis. This is also an opportunity to build greener and to really think about where those new economic opportunities are going to emerge, not just for the high skill workers, but also for the low skill workers, and how we use that as an engine for recovery for the poor and vulnerable. And then finally, there is no doubt that doing all of this is going to require resources. You know, we can realize some efficiency gains along the way, but the reality is that governments are going to need resources to spend on these new investments. And what that means is that they're going to have to mobilize domestic resources. And this links a little bit to your sort of question in terms of the social contract. That is a discussion, right, about, well, who is going to pay and for what? And in many of the countries that we work on, I think there is room for the fiscal system overall to be more progressive. I think that's a conversation that we should be having.
Yes, yes. I guess this is going to be a very serious challenge for many governments because, as you know, all these public interventions and measures that were taken in 2020 to mitigate the impact of COVID, of course, have led also to very high levels of public debt. No, you know, Spain is a very interesting example. It's not by any means a low income country, but on the fiscal side, you have seen the evolution of public debt levels go from 37% of GDP in 2007 before the global financial crisis, about 100% of GDP by 2020 because of the accumulation of, you know, deficits throughout that period. And today, I guess, probably about 120% of GDP, right? So you have had a more than tripling of public debt levels over a period of 13, 14 years. And it does raise questions about, you know, the future ability of governments to work within that constrained fiscal space to do the kind of social policies that we will protect populations in the future. Now, you are the director of the World Bank's Poverty and Equity Global Practice, and thus let us turn our attention to the second part of your portfolio. As with poverty, the data suggests, obviously, that we have a serious problem. I think there is a universal perception from academics to development organizations like the World Bank to, you know, civil society and the media. Our former colleague Branko Milanovic has written several books on the subject in recent years, full of fascinating stories and data and examples that highlight the full extent of the problem. To the point where more and more people, at least those that I talk to, are no longer thinking of income inequality as a purely economic problem, you know, but they're already worried about the political ramifications and the way in which, if unaddressed, if unresolved, you know, could undermine the very basis of democracy in many parts of the world. So you see, for instance, what happened in Chile in late 2019, a country that has made great progress in Latin America in reducing poverty, and yet it was all of a sudden in the middle of, you know, protests in the streets. And the perception there is that one important component of that was this sense that income distribution is a problem that has been not particularly well dealt with by the authorities. What are your sort of two or three favorite policy prescriptions to address income disparities? I'm sure you have 10, but let's focus on the most important.
I was going to say this is a much longer conversation, but, you know, let me sort of maybe just highlight three that I think are particularly important. The first one of those is to invest in opportunities, particularly for children. And the reason I say that is that I think when we talk about inequality, we tend to focus a lot on income inequality or wealth inequality. And that's what gets a lot of attention in the press and in the public debate. But the reality is that behind that, what we have is a real crisis in terms of inequality of opportunity, meaning different citizens face very different opportunities when it comes to being able to realize their potential and to move ahead in life. And that is particularly the case for children. So the data that we have, the latest data that we have, suggests that if you're a child born to a poor family, you're very likely to be poor as an adult. And in contrast, if you're a child born to a rich family, you're very likely to be rich as an adult, kind of independently almost of what you as an individual can contribute to society. And to me, that's deeply unfair. So I think the first sort of order for policy makers is making sure that that playing field is level, at least for children. And that really means two things. One is much more serious investment in health and education services that are not just inclusive, but that deliver quality for everybody. And the second is investment in basic infrastructure, you know, making sure that kids have access to water and sanitation and that they have access to electricity. We have enormous amounts of evidence showing that these investments are critical for things like nutrition, for kids to be able to learn at home, etc. So that to me is, you know, the top of the list. You know, we need to make these investments today so that these kids, when they grow up, have a chance of having a more equitable society. And I'm not sure that we are fully internalizing that. The second issue to me is, you know, now turning, if you want, to the adults of today, right? It's investing in the productive capacity of adults and ensuring that markets are equitable. And I say this because very frequently, when we think about poverty, when we think about inequality and people being left behind, a lot of us kind of immediately think about the remedy being cash transfers. You know, let's give people money. And that may be needed in some cases. And there may be people who are unable to work and who do need that kind of income support. But the reality is that the best we can do for these people to make sure that they are able to catch up with the rest of the population and therefore inequality declines is to increase their productivity and to help them be able to pull themselves out of poverty. And what that means is we need to invest in their human capital, but also in their physical and financial capital and in their social capital, something that you were talking a little bit about before when you talked about, you know, relationships and the social contract. Likewise, you know, markets in many countries just don't work for the worse off. You know, they only work for the well off, right? I mean, we have many markets that are not competitive, that are dominated by a few providers. We need to ensure that firms, a small, medium, micro, are able to access these markets. They are able to better connect across space, and, you know, ideally with world markets. So again, a whole set of investments around increasing the productivity of certain groups and making markets more contestable and equitable to me is kind of a second priority. And then finally, something we were talking about earlier, that is, use the power of fiscal policy. Fiscal policy is one of the most powerful tools that governments have at their disposal to influence the distribution of income. And by this, I mean both on the tax side and the spending side. I think we usually focus either on one or the other, depending on our sort of professional biases. And I actually think it's important to look at both combined and the net effect that they have on the distribution of income.
Thank you, Carolina. Very interesting. Amanda Ellis, who used to be New Zealand's ambassador to the United Nations, and actually in an earlier time in her career, actually worked at the IFC, recently gave a talk in which she argued that some of the more successful cases of COVID-19 management in countries like Iceland, New Zealand, Taiwan, Norway, Finland, Denmark, and there are others, are in countries where either the prime minister or the head of state is a woman. The data suggests that they have prioritized approaches based on science and empirical evidence, have implemented policies characterized by inclusiveness, transparency, flexibility. Now, you were part of the team, as I said before, during the introduction, that put together the World Development Report in 2012 on gender equality and development, which it seems to me made a compelling case for the benefits that would accrue to countries around the world by the economic and the political empowerment of women. How do you see the role of gender equality and women's empowerment in the search for solutions to our twin challenges of poverty and widened income disparities and or opportunities, as you mentioned?
As you were asking that question, I was going back to sort of the messages of the report, which was written now almost 10 years ago. And And reflecting that, I suspect most of those messages are actually equally pertinent today, which maybe is a testimony to how slowly some of these things move over time. So let me maybe sort of, you know, remember some of those messages and then, you know, reflect on how they may apply to the situation today. So the one liner, I think the one sort of big message that we try to put forward in the report was that gender equality was not only the right thing to do, we thought, and I think we were quite explicit about that, but it was also smart economics. It was the sort of the smart thing to do from the perspective of your ministers of finance and, you know, and those that are really worried about kind of economic development and economic growth. And there's enormous amounts of evidence out there that basically shows why that's the case. But what was, you know, in terms of, you know, when you have more equal outcomes for men and women and, you know, girls and boys, what you see is higher living standards, better outcomes for children, and, you know, touching upon something that you alluded to in your question, you know, institutions that work better and sort of more effective decision-making processes. And again, we documented this extensively, and I suspect that the evidence in support of those claims has only increased in the last few years. The interesting part is that some gender gaps kind of go away with development. Right. So as countries get richer, you know, these gaps close, and there's almost like a natural cycle. Policy can accelerate that. But, you know, to some extent, it's almost a byproduct of development. And, you know, access to education sort of falls on that category. But there are many gender gaps that don't go away with development. They are sort of sticky. Access to economic opportunities is one of them. And, you know, empowerment, voice, representation in decision making, it's another one that we highlighted in the report. Very clearly. And, you know, I think progress has happened in that sphere, but probably not as much as we would have wanted to see. So my view on this is, and we, you know, it's the same that I had 10 years ago, that is, we will not be able to not just meet the extreme poverty goal, to meet, I think, any of the sustainable development goals if we are not counting on 50% of the global population, right? If we are not leveraging the power of women and girls in moving along some of these dimensions. And, you know, maybe just echoing what I said before, I mean, what that means is that, you know, if you're thinking about investing in education and health, well, it has to work for boys and girls. And that's a combination of systemic policies and some targeted policies. If you're thinking about, you know, investing in the productivity of particular segments of the population, you have to think about the constraints that women face to access markets, to participate in the labor force. You know, how do they juggle sort of household responsibilities and care responsibilities with being, you know, workers and, you know, actors in the labor market? And I think increasingly we are also turning our attention to better understanding what the gender impacts of fiscal policy are. And I don't mean just in terms of gender budgeting, which I think it's a very limited way of thinking about this, but really understanding the kinds of incentives and constraints that fiscal policy, taxation, you know, program requirements, etc., generate for different types of households depending on their composition. You know, do you have men? Do you have women? Are they married? Are they single? You know, and we see a lot happening there. Just to end, all of this, in my view, it's becoming increasingly urgent given what we see happening under COVID. We suspected early in the pandemic that it could have a devastating impact for women. Karen Brown, who's my colleague at the bank that focuses on gender, and myself wrote a blog, you know, almost a year ago, saying, let's be careful. This could be very disequalizing for women. And I think all the evidence that we've had emerging in both high-income, middle-income, and low-income countries supports that. I think women have been disproportionately affected by the crisis, and that has only, on the one hand, wiped out some of the gains that we had seen recently, and on the other, sort of exacerbated some of the gaps that, you know, have been sticky for a long time. So it's urgent, and I think the recipes are there. We know what they are. A lot of it is about political will. And changes in social norms, and, you know, for societies to really sort of think about this differently and view women and girls as, you know, valuable and proactive members of society.
And of course, I'm sure you are aware that the COVID-19 also has had an impact on the incidence of violence against women.
Yes.
Which
yes.
already was a very serious problem, as you know.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, a couple of weeks ago, I was having a chat with our former colleague, Branko Milanovic, and I asked him about his views on universal basic income, and in particular, whether they had changed in the course of the pandemic. And he said that his views had changed, that he was skeptical before, but that he saw many advantages now in the context of the current crisis. What do you think? What are your views on universal basic income?
So as somebody who works on poverty, right, and who sort of has as a goal or sort of a vision for my work, you know, to eliminate poverty, in a way, you could think about that as ensuring that everybody has a certain minimum level of income, right, that is above the poverty line. So at the very philosophical level, you know, I completely subscribe to that statement. You know, we need to be in a world where everybody has a certain level of income. I think where I have a little bit of an issue is how do we move to that goal, right? And the main issue that I have with the discussion on a universal basic income, the way it's framed, it's one of affordability, particularly in a low income, you know, low middle income environment. The reality is that, you know, in these countries, as we were talking about a little bit earlier, you know, resources are limited. There are many investment priorities. And the cost of basically transferring a minimum amount of money to everybody, which is what this is on paper, is extremely high. And in many cases, not affordable. Or the trade-offs associated with that are very, very high. So if that's the route, right, if the route is, okay, we think about this as a transfer, then my take is that this has to be a CMA-targeted transfer. So, you know, for people below a certain threshold, which could be higher than the poverty line. You know, that's something for societies to decide. You know, it's a bit like the checks in the US, right, the relief checks. It's a threshold. It's clearly not the poverty threshold. It's a much higher threshold, but there is a threshold. So that's something I feel comfortable with. The second thing that I think we tend to forget is that governments, you know, can influence people's incomes in many different ways. So fiscal policy is, of course, one of them, and a very direct way. But governments regulate. They legislate. They have impact on how markets and institutions work. So to me, part of ensuring that everybody is able to earn or to, you know, to access the minimum level of income, it's also about ensuring that those institutions and those markets function in ways that are equitable, that don't exclude certain people, that provide them with those opportunities. And then when you combine that, you know, the fiscal power, the regulatory power of governments, then I think that goal of a universal basic income becomes something that is much more attainable without putting that much strain on fiscal policy. So that's how I sort of square, you know, my philosophical sort of subscription to the idea with the reality that many of the governments that we work with face.
Carolina, about half of the close to 180,000 followers of the Global Governance Forum in Facebook are under the age of 24. Many of them are not only alarmed at some of the risks we face in coming years as a result of the multiple unresolved global problems, several of which you have mentioned in your own comments, poverty, inequality, lack of opportunity, climate change. But these young people are actively seeking for forms of engagement and asking themselves, you know, what is the role of youth in the future of development? Please, to conclude this very interesting podcast, speak to them.
What to say? I think we tend to underestimate how much power we have as individuals. And, you know, and that's more so for youth, because I think you're freer in your choices and the energy that you bring to those. So I think what I would tell them is think of yourselves as powerful consumers. You know, you can influence what markets and firms do you can advocate for particular behaviors in the corporate world. Think of yourselves as powerful workers. We have seen, even during the pandemic, you know, how powerful groups of workers can be when they come together, again, to influence the way that firms operate, that markets work, you know, advocating for compensation, advocating for more fairness, you know, in the market. Think of yourselves as powerful voters. You know, exercise that power at every opportunity that you have. And ultimately, think of yourselves as powerful private citizens and think about what you can influence, not just in the big sort of scene, but in your own particular private scene. I mean, my kids are much younger. They are 14 and 12. But I'm amazed by how they're able to leverage social media, their connections, to be informed, much more informed than I was at their age, and to be active in pursuing what they're interested in. And you know, I imagine, you know, somebody who's years older having so much more power to really make use of those platforms. So that's what I would say. You know, change is possible, and global change is ultimately only the sum of every individual change that we are all managing. So exercise the power that you have in all those different spheres of your life, even if you don't think of yourselves as powerful.
Thank you, Carolina.
No, thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Global Governance Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with friends and family. To learn more, please visit globalgovernanceforum.org and join the conversation.